Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Australian Studies Channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bede Haynes, and before we begin, I'd like to pay my respect to the First Nations people of Australia on whose land I'm sitting. And today's show, we're interviewing Carmen McLean. She is a professor of history in the South Asian Institute at the University of Heidelberg. If I've got that wrong, Carmen will correct me. I should actually ask if that's the correct way to even say Dr. McLean's name, but we'll come to that in a second. We're talking about her book, British India and White Australia, from 2020, published by New South Press in Australia. And first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, B.
Is Karma correct?
Karma is correct.
Ah, very good. Now, I have read your book, which is very interesting. It's, first of all, could you let me know how a bit about your background and how you came to write this book, British India and White Australia?
So I have been working as a historian of South Asia for much of my career, really for the last, say, 30 years. But I've been based in Australia. It's only very recently that I've moved to Germany to take up this position. And so my specialization has been Indian nationalism and on the politics of communication about ideas of nationalism in North India primarily. And I've spent a lot of time in archives in that time. And although my focus was very much on happenings in North India, I was never, and I was always surprised actually, when I saw Australia somehow mentioned in some of the things that I was reading about. And over time, these really started to accumulate. And I started to think that perhaps there was a historical project here that could be looked at, in which we could understand the British Empire perhaps more fruitfully through the lens of settler colonialism in the Australian case, and comparing that with the experience of British colonialism in India. So that was one thing that got me started in the project. And I think the other thing that really pushed me was the sort of crisis around a number of racist attacks in Australia starting in 2008, 9, 10, as large numbers of Indian students were in Australia and coming up against, repeated forms of discrimination, and some of which actually ended up in violence and murder, actually, in at least one case. And this really created a crisis, I think, for Australia-India relations. And I felt that needed to be addressed. And so I felt like a historical perspective on the history of how Australians perceive India would actually be quite constructive in that particular situation. And I was also, a lot of my students were, either born in India or grew up in Australia or had come from India and were talking to me about their experiences as well. And I wanted to sort of translate that into history writing. And So this book, which is a real departure from my earlier work, came to being, I suppose. It didn't come to being very quickly, but it came nonetheless.
Mm. Could you, the name of the book, British India, White Australia, it seems to me to present a plate, two places, neither of which I think sound particularly attractive. Could you explain the title of the book?
Yeah, sure. It's actually a good point. So British India refers to the state of India, I mean, under colonialism. And it, I mean, formally, this is the period from 1858, although, of course, the history of the British in India goes way beyond that, earlier than that. And, of course, India is decolonized and becomes the states of India and Pakistan in 1947. And this is a period whereby India has has extremely little political independent subjectivity. It has no independence, no ability to craft its own policies, economic policies, external relations for the purposes of this particular book. And, you know, of course, I think everyone's at least vaguely familiar with the narrative of the movement against the British in India, which builds up over the course of the, you know, starting from the late 19th century and reaches a crescendo in the mid-20th century, in the 1940s, where a number of anti-colonial movements come together, primarily that of the Indian National Congress, but also the Muslim League. And India is decolonized in 1947. And becomes these two nation states. So that's the British India part of the story. And it describes, I guess, this sort of vexed relationship between British, British ideas about India and how Indians manage the experience of colonization. And I've glossed over a lot there. It's a long-standing, brutal and humiliating process for many Indians, and it's not a period of history that is remembered with great fondness. And I mention that because I was often sort of called into, you know, second-track diplomacy when I was in Australia, and I often saw our Indian interlocutors being reminded that we were all part of the British Empire. And most Indians don't think of that as being something to be fondly remembered. They think of it as a time of great oppression actually comprehensive oppression. And Australians didn't seem to realise this. Australians seemed to think that the experience of colonialism in India could be likened to that in Australia. Now, I think for Australia's Indigenous people, that's probably a fair comment, perhaps. I think the experience of colonization for Indigenous people has been actually very devastating. But for white Australians, it was a very different kind of process. Again, in Australia, we do have, I think, a very marked form of ongoing anti-colonial sentiment, but I don't think it's nearly as rigorous or extensive as what we see in South Asia. And that is because white Australia was white. We were not treated as being, fundamentally different. Australians were seen as being colonial, and that didn't always come with particularly positive connotations either, but we were still white and therefore were able to Australians were able to project and demand a certain amount of self-governance from a relatively early period, which in the Indian case was never accepted by the British. Mm. And then, of course, we have describing how, the British see Australia being white, but then we have an aggressive policy. Immigration policy, known as the White Australia Policy informally, which prevents the further arrival after 1901, after Federation, of non-white people to Australia to settle. Now, of course, in the 19th century, there were considerable numbers of Chinese, lesser numbers of Japanese, but also actually a sizable body of Indians who had come to settle in the colony as free settlers. And that that was prevented after 1901, and for a number of reasons, which we can talk about throughout the interview. But British India and White Australia is a way I wanted to point out the real differences between the colonial experience in India and the colonial experience in Australia, to suggest that we perhaps can't compare them and expect them to be a point of community, perhaps.
Yes, that was one thing I did take from the book. It actually had never was something that I never found was particularly well taught in Australia and in my Australian school education, is that they really are these two colonial settlements. And it's funny that the British seem to want to keep them both homogenous, almost to say, well, here are the new white people in Australia. Now there's Indigenous people, we'll forget them and you just must stay white. And in India was almost the reverse, to say, well, yes, you are all these people who live here traditionally, but you're not going to our other colonies. You're stuck here and we'll control the terms on which you go elsewhere.
So, in fact, it was even more complicated than that, because in theory, the British like to project an idea of the empire being essentially one space where everybody could roam freely. And there were a number of... there was in the aftermath of the Great Indian Rebellion in 1857, Queen Victoria sets out a proclamation which acts as a Magna Carta, a series of promises that will guide British rule in India henceforth. Now, of course, the British very quickly depart from that, and much of the politics of the late 19th century is about, Indian... activists testing those promises and watching them fail a lot of the time. And one of those promises was that, that we will treat all of our imperial citizens equally, something to that effect. And, Gandhi himself in South Africa used this and reinterpreted it slightly to suggest that we are guaranteed equal treatment with your white subjects, and yet we are... subject to very, very different and extremely negative treatment, in fact, in places like South Africa. And so the British were often, that was a real, I think what we'd call in Australia a gotcha moment. It was very hard for the British to negotiate around that, because Gandhi was correct, actually. And so there continues to be throughout the 20th century this sort of a constant dialogue where Indians are claiming these rights that are enshrined in this proclamation, which include equal treatment of all imperial citizens. But in fact, what the British have done is set up these settler societies who become, they actually style themselves as the Dominions explicitly to assert their difference as white colonies, and to demand different treatment and different political, subjectivity as a result of that, including, of course, the right to self-governance, which is explicitly denied India throughout this period. So the British themselves actually would have liked Australia and South Africa and Canada to allow a certain amount of free movement, and frequently asked them to at least have a low quota system, allowing a small number of people in. However, the right to self-governance was always drawn upon by all of those settler colonies, actually, as being an inalienable right for them to set the terms of their immigration programs. And again, that discourse is something I think that would resonate for many Australians, because it's something that we have heard in recent decades as well. That, yes, the right to self, determination is somehow inextricably linked to our immigration programs. So there's a longer history of racism that comes into play there as well.
I kept, when I was reading the book, I kept in my mind listening to, playing over and over again, John Howard saying, "We decide who comes here in the terms on which they do." It just seemed that was and that's the next part I wanted to ask you about. So the White Australia policy seemed to have a sense of that the white people in Australia decide who comes here. We set the tests. With the tests, if you could explain, I'd like you to explain what the policy was for those. Some listeners overseas might not know about the White Australia policy, and then what drove it? Why was it needed? Why did the Australian populace think this was needed if they did?
So this is where I think one of my contributions is to emphasise the role of British Indians in the framing of these policies. So now, in fact, many Australian prime ministers would often, when challenged in London about the White Australia policy, they would say with absolute truthfulness, there is no White Australia policy on the Australian, in Australian statute books or legislation. It doesn't exist. And technically that was true. The words White Australia were never mentioned. And that was actually a strategic manoeuvre. The Immigration Restriction Act, which is the formal name of the legislation that was passed in 1901, was in itself, the implementation of White Australia was actually in the administration of the Act and not actually in the Act itself. And interestingly, the way in which the Act would be administered was also actually very hard to find written down. The instructions did exist at some stage, but actually are still very hard to actually trace in the archives. But the practice was effectively to, and again, this is something that the British asked the Australian government to do, taking an example from one of the African colonies, Natal. They had worked out that you could actually discriminate against people on the basis of race by asking them to undertake a language test. Now, a language test seems to be an objective knowledge test that in itself is not racist. But, of course, in the application of the language test in Australia, it was entirely, and it evolved over about a four-year period until they perfected how to do this. But initially, in 1901, the test was a language test that was in English. And the newly arrived person, usually on the boat itself before they could even get off, were required to write out a text in English as it was dictated. Mm. Now, of course, many Indians could speak English and they passed this test very well. And so it was realised very quickly that this was not going to work to prevent Indian labour. It prevented a large number of Chinese and Japanese and others who didn't speak English. But because, India was part of the British Empire, English education was, I wouldn't say widespread, but, most people who were migrating could actually manage an English language test. And so then the policy evolved between 1901 and 1904 to allow the person to be given a test in Swedish or Norwegian or some other unlikely European language that they would be sure to fail. And then on objective terms, they would be told that they'd failed the test and they would need to get back on the boat and leave Australia. So this was the mechanism through which Australia was kept white, by administering a language test that, interrogated, didn't look racist, but in fact was in its application.
And there were also, if a person was lucky enough to be able to pass this test and get into Australia, could you let me know some of the restrictions that still remained on Indian immigrants into Australia, on labour, on voting and things like that?
Sure. Again, this differentiated between states. So some states were better than others in terms of allowing Indians the right to vote, for example. So, in fact, there was already an Indian community in Australia in 1901 when the Immigration Act was passed. And they were actually given, they were conceded the rights of residency, but they weren't really conceded rights of citizenship. So they were not able to vote in federal elections, although they could in some state elections. So that was something of an anomaly that was challenged in the 1920s. But they couldn't claim pensions. And this was a real point of contention because many of these people had actually fought in imperial wars overseas in the Boer War, for example, before they came to Australia. And some, in fact, even volunteered in the Great War as well. Excuse me. So there is this sort of one of the stories that I tell is the gradual escalation of claims for citizenship by Indian communities in Australia. And the numbers are fairly low, especially relative to the Chinese community, which was much more substantial, but the numbers are probably around 7,000. And they start to dwindle. A lot of Indians, in fact, leave Australia in the early 20th century because they find it so restrictive. The key point, of course, is that they are unable to bring family members to come and live with them, and which effectively it means that either many Indian men marry Australians, and you know, again, the numbers there are fairly small, but that does happen. But many men, of course, migrate already married and are unable to bring family members with them. In theory, they're allowed to bring their wives, but they're not allowed to bring adult children and they're not allowed to bring their parents. And, of course, the extended – that would have entailed the breakup of the extended Indian family unit. So what in fact happened was a lot of men who migrated – who were unable to bring their families, worked in Australia and sent money home and visited them once every few years, if that. So they were really forced to live quite isolated lives, many of these men, those who didn't marry Australians and settle. Then there were also restrictions on how they could labour, the kinds of work and industries they could actually find employment in. And again, this depended on the state, but many Indians were prevented from working in the sugar industry, mining, hospitality, manufacturing. And actually that was quite a comprehensive list. So again, this was meant to be a policy to maintain the salary levels, if you like, or the wage levels of white men. And it was based around fears that non-white labour would be cheaper,
right,
and therefore a form of competition.
Could I ask you this?
Yeah.
I was going to say, with the people who come to Australia from what we now call India, that within that country itself is a massive population and there are various different regions. Would the actual people from India in the early 1900s have considered themselves a unified people? So someone from Gujarat and someone from Kerala, would they think of themselves as being part of the same nation? Or is that something that we've imposed on them?
I don't think we imposed it on them so much as, I mean, this is a much longer process, I think, that builds over a much longer durée, actually. So I think there is a lot of regional identity that is in particular enshrined within linguistic differences. But right. I do think there is also a shared understanding that we see growing through the 20th century that, that you know, someone from, let's say, Punjab and someone from, let's say, Madras, as it was then, come from an entity that is part of British India. And so that is a larger solidarity that starts to come together in the 20th century. I talk in the book about British India as a term, excuse me, and it's actually a strategic term that many Indians use because they know that by appealing to themselves as British Indians, that they are reminding Australian legislators or politicians or interlocutors that we are actually part of an empire, and they do have a larger claim within that imperial subjecthood, if not citizenship, to being treated the same way as Australians were. So British India is a political category and, again, a strategic manoeuvre by many Indian associations and individuals during this period who are fighting for, what we would call now, you know, rights, basic civil rights, actually, in Australia.
Yes. And the book, there's a persistent image in parts of the book of Indian men in turbans in horse-drawn wagons as hawkers travelling around regional Australia selling things. Could I ask you how that practice came about, and why did it seem to capture at least the popular imagination of the locals?
So because there were so many limitations on where Indians could work in forms of, you know, not being able to work in manufacturing and not being able to work in mining and, the sugar industries, for example, they were usually forced into effectively freelance kinds of work, and many of them found work in hawking. It was regulated, but it didn't prevent them from actually working as such. They also had, of course, access through their linkages in India to Indian products as well, which were actually, there was an enormous demand for in Australia, in particular cloth, for example. So large numbers of Indians who found themselves in Australia and who committed to staying, at least for the time being, actually worked as hawkers. And, of course, this was in a period in Australia where rural areas were not particularly well connected by rail or by road. Mm-hmm. And so the hawker, horse and cart, was providing a much-needed commodity to especially rural Australians. And so they were actually a feature of Indian, Australian rural life. And also, with a presence as well in Australian capital cities.
Yes, and wearing a turban, I picture that as being someone who's of the Sikh background. Is that accurate, or was it a much broader practice than that amongst Indians who came to Australia?
Well, there's different kinds of wearing turbans, different ways in which a turban is wrapped, and often the meaning that's attached to that. So Sikhs do wear turbans, but there were also a large number of other Indians who settled in Australia who also wore turbans, and that often reflected regional religious identities as well. We can get a really good sense of this actually by trawling through the collection of certificates to waive the holder of the certificate from doing the dictation test. So these were something that any person who had settled in Australia before 1901 could get when they went to India. And this would mean that they wouldn't be subject to the dictation test when they arrived, because it was recognised that they had established the right to live in Australia. And so it was a kind of a pre-passport document. But on all of these certificates are photographs of Indians and their names and their sort of biodata, where they were born, what colour eyes they had, what distinctive markings they had. And so there is an extraordinary photography collection there that I used and that has been popularized by the artist Peter Drew in a recent series, Aussie series that many Australians will be familiar with, because it's been a regular feature now of the Australian street art landscape.
Yes, and could I ask you, when you're talking there about photographic collections, you mentioned in the book some archives that have access to lots of photographs, family photographs and things like that. Could I ask you what role that had in preparing, how that affects doing history as a historian, those sort of resources now available?
Sure. So a lot of one of the real problems that I had in writing the book was to find, textual records, documents written by Indians themselves in Australia. Because, I mean, ultimately what I was trying to do was to try and uncover some of their stories and experiences. Now, of course, the overwhelming amount of textual data that I had access to was either government, generated reports, which were actually a lot of the time responding to perceived problems. It was actually quite negative in its nature. So, for example, we would get, we would find legislation and debates, before the legislation was passed in particular, which talks about the problem of Indians wanting to come to Australia and what this would actually mean for white Australia. And in this we find, what we would call, discourses pulling in opposite directions, that Indians can't come to Australia because they are not sufficiently modern or educated and they are just too different to us. And then in other parts of the same argument, we find that they are in fact considered to be a threat, actually, because they are becoming educated and are able to understand and compete, actually, with Australian workers on an equal par. And so we get these sort of contradictory racial discourses which kind of make no sense. So I didn't find those particularly useful in understanding, how people themselves experienced being in Australia, living in Australia on a day-to-day basis. And then we had the Australian newspapers, which, were often full of, racist diatribe, actually. And that also didn't really provide a very clear window into the lives of these people. But what I did find was what we would call vernacular photography, meaning photographs taken by early Kodak cameras by ordinary people who made a choice. I mean, photography, in the 1920s, 1930s was a very expensive medium. And one thought very carefully about taking a photograph because it was a commitment, it was a financial commitment. And I found it very interesting that, there was a lot of attempts, particularly around the time of the Bicentennial in Australia, to curate photography collections that provided us an insight into ordinary life, in Australia's first two centuries post-colonisation. And a lot of Indian hawkers came up in this collection. And that sort of made me think, well, actually, a lot of people felt that these people were worth taking photographs of, that they were important to them. And then I tried to read the photographs. When you look at the photographs closely, you find a number of things. You do find, and you can see photographs where clearly the photographer has taken a photograph of this person without their consent, and the person is aware of having their photograph taken. They're not particularly happy about it, and they're not engaging with the photographer. And that's a disturbing phenomenon, of course. But I also found photographs of men looking at their photographers and smiling and posing very consciously for the photograph. And a lot of the time we would find on the back of the photograph the name of the Indian hawker who had been photographed, and a little story about him that, we used to buy this from him or that from him, and he used to love playing cards. And that gave us, I think, it gives us a much better sense of some of the more neighbourly interactions between Indian hawkers and white Australians, which I think, for me anyway, was it gave us a slightly more optimistic sense of the ways in which Indians lived in white Australia. I don't think it was ever easy. I do think there was pervasive racism, but they did make friends as well, and people did learn their names, and they did play cards with people, and there were some relationships that transcended that racial barrier and the forms of racial difference, which were so pervasive in the media, in newspapers, in fiction, and eventually in film as well.
Yes. So that's well, that sounds like to me that was a breakthrough almost in the way history can be done. That sounds very, very good to me. One on that point, I'd like to ask, you have the images you've just described of the people in the streets without any necessarily open hostility, and then you have great extracts in the book from cartoons and advertisements that really would just be deemed to be racist. And we're talking about some in the Bulletin, which is a leading publication in Australia by Norman Lindsay, a leading artist in Australia, that really depict a racist view of Indians. Can you talk about how that culture came to arise, where you could put in a public newspaper an offensive image?
So, I mean, the Bulletin was well known for its aggressive valorization of white Australia, and in fact, this was not particularly unusual. And in fact, the images in my book are relatively mild for the Bulletin's usual standard, unfortunately. The images by Norman Lindsay and later by his brother Lionel Lindsay that I focus on begin as an advertisement series based around the figure of Chunder Lu, who is starts life in 1909 as an Indian hawker who is advertising boot polish. And he starts off as a relatively benign character, but he becomes a weekly feature of the Bulletin, and he develops a narrative which pulls in all kinds of directions. You know, in one week he dreams of training racehorses and winning the Melbourne Cup, and in another week he becomes an Australian politician who actually platforms in favour of the White Australia policy. In another week he's following Halley's Comet. In another week he is traveling to what is discussed as home, and visiting South Asia. He actually goes back to Colombo. So again, there's this sort of geographical confusion about where he's actually from. The series begins with him coming from Bengal, and then a decade later he's from Colombo. But in the Australian imagination, certainly in the Lindsay brothers' imagination, it's all one. So. And there's parts of Chunder Lu that can be read as being very much within the tradition of Kipling-esque representations of Indian masculinity, as being, kind and, servile and non-threatening, reliable, dependable, and a number of other kind of tropes that we would be familiar with through some of Kipling's more famous work, Gunga Din and The Jungle Book, for example. Yes. Now, he ends up fighting in the Great War, and his narrative in the Great War, where he fights alongside a koala bear and a dog who's always with him as well, was, I argue, it was a weekly feature of the Bulletin. It was still in an advertising form, but it became an adventure story that children in particular demanded. And so Chunder Lu becomes a real phenomenon in Australia, which I do think, despite it being actually profoundly racist, particularly in today's terms, it actually starts to shift the idea. It introduces to Australians the idea that Indians are actually fighting in a war that we are part of as well. And I think that does actually substantially shift understandings of Indians in Australia in the 1920s, which is actually when the fight for their rights as citizens really wraps up, and in which eventually in 1924 Indians are given the vote in Australia federally. Mm. Yeah.
Now with I want to come back to World War II in a little bit, but one question before, to keep a chronological order, I wanted to ask. In the 1920s, you'd have a section which was eye-opening for me with the tariffs that were pro-Australian and against India, where it was cheaper in India to buy wheat imported from Australia. That, to me, seems bizarre. Could you give us some insight into the background to that?
Sure. Look, very briefly, there were imperial, there was a shared, trade, a community, I guess you would call, in which tariffs were reduced for, countries from around the empire. And what this actually meant was that large amounts of Australian wheat could effectively be dumped in India. And in fact, so in India, Australia was famous for two things. One was White Australia, which was understood not necessarily as a policy but a place. I mean, Australia becomes understood as being white. So White Australia is how it's, the two terms are almost ubiquitous in India when Australia is mentioned. And the other thing Australia is known for is its wheat. It's an abundant source of wheat, but also the flooding of Indian markets with Australian wheat, which actually undermines Indian growers, especially in wheat areas, in particular Punjab, where incidentally many of the Australian residents also came from, Australian residents came from as well. So this became a source of much resentment, actually, that Australia was able to take advantage of imperial trade policies to dump its wheat. And in fact, eventually there was protective legislation in the 1920s which prevented that. And it actually causes a real shock to the Australian economy, and it eventually prompts the establishment of a trade commissioner in India, an Australian trade commissioner who's placed within one of the Indian governments of India departments, which was of course British run, to advocate for Australian trade interests in matters of Indian trade. But it was certainly a major point of contention in India.
Then as the century progresses, India becomes a republic in 1947. I think that's the actual same day as Australia Day, wasn't it, 26th of January?
So technically India becomes a republic in 1950 because the legislation to make it so is passed on January 26.
Right.
But that in itself also celebrates the 26th of January in 1930, which was a day coordinated by Gandhi and the Indian National Congress to declare that from now on India would not settle for dominion status. So it did not want to be a colony like Canada or Australia or New Zealand. It wanted to be an independent nation. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, it does end up negotiating, which takes some time. It's a negotiation with Britain, but also there's obviously legislation in India and the constitution that needs to be negotiated. But it does, in fact, manage to gain acceptance, including amongst by the other dominions, that it has a reasonable claim to be a republic within the Commonwealth. And that is obviously a particular constitutional status that it insists upon and is granted. But that takes some time to negotiate, so hence the 1950.
Right. And at this, one of the parts of the book is what's known as the Quit India Movement, and Gandhi is involved in that. And it seems, could you explain what that was and what that movement was all about?
Sure. So the Quit India Movement was Gandhi's last great movement. Movement for Indian independence has usually been explained with reference to Gandhi and the Congress. I think it's it's something I've problematized in my other research, but for the purposes of our discussion here, Australians observed Indian claims for independence with a growing sense of anxiety for what that would mean for Australia. So We see a lot of anxiety in Australia with Gandhi's first movement, and that's the non-cooperation movement in the 1920s, which comes on the aftermath of the Great War. And the feeling in Australia, if I could generalize, is one of quite a surprise, actually, and a failure to understand this desire for India to leave the great British empire. And so there's not a lot of sympathy, I don't think you could say, in the 1920s. By the 1940s, there's been a number of really radical changes which alter the way in which many Australians see Indian aggressive Indian independence movements. And I would say that the Quit India movement is the most strident of all of the movements. And that is because, obviously, it's in the context of the Great War. You know, Gandhi explicitly and many other nationalist groups explicitly refrain from demanding independence or performing non-cooperation in the Great War. But by the 1940s, the political state in India was just no longer acceptable for Indian nationalists, and explicit promises of decolonization were actually a condition for much Indian participation in the war, in the Second World War. And when the British started to prevaricate around that in 1942, Gandhi called the Quit India movement. He was immediately put in jail. The movement very quickly spirals out of control. It's a violent movement. It becomes a violent movement. It is put down violently as well. Now, interestingly, not a lot of this gets through to Australia because there's extensive press censorship, both in India and externally. And so I still think we get I don't think we have a very strong understanding of the development of the Quit India movement relative to Gandhi's earlier movements, especially his 1930s campaign of the Salt March, which was extensively televised. Televised is the wrong word, but filmed and very well projected overseas, actually, especially in the US. So I think our understanding of the Quit India movement in Australia was actually quite weak. We were still heavily reliant on British sources of information, which were, of course, profoundly imperial. So I still don't think we had a very good understanding of the Quit India movement in Australia.
The book actually has some very insightful passages I found about the press suppression of the news from India and actually how it infiltrated directly into Australia, into Canberra. And it seemed when you read it now, you think, far out, this is just controlled news. The government of India, which I read as being the British interests, are just telling people how to think about what's happening in India in a way that favours the British.
Absolutely. I mean, there were press communiques that came out and that were sent to Canberra, and Canberra was asked to to circulate these amongst news. You know, they were basically press releases, which gave a particular interpretation of, for example, Gandhi's what they call self-imposed fast, urged Australian newspapers to talk about Gandhi's self-imposed fast as being something that he brought about himself, and basically encouraged an unsympathetic interpretation of it in the Australian press. And Australian news media did fairly faithfully reproduce that. So, yes, there is a very deliberate attempt by the British government of India, but also relevant offices in London, to project a particular interpretation of Indian nationalism as being extreme, unreasonable, and even laughable in some periods in Australia. Yes. And that is projected to a degree. There is also a counter discourse, though, in Australia that is starting to take hold in the 1940s, and I think that's what really makes the difference.
I was going to ask you about that counter discourse. Is that where you talk about the got my note here. There were a couple of movements. There was the Australia India League, and that might have been a bit earlier. But was that they seemed to really fight hard to even be heard in the beginning?
Yeah. So there's a number of what I would call you know, India lobby groups in Australia that grow up. I mean, there are obviously Indian organizations that are organized and run by Indians resident in Australia in the early 20th century, which are mainly organized around projecting a sense of Indian, you know, the rights of Indian subjects in Australia and demanding their rights as citizens. But this is actually something different. This is actually white Australians lobbying and mobilizing in order to project a better understanding of Indian politics in Australia. And it's mainly coming from journalists who spend time in India in the First World War, but also in the interwar period. Many of these people actually, you know, there's also a distinct voice, pro-India voice in Australia that comes out of the Theosophical Society, which is it's a counter movement, it's a countercurrent, but actually a very influential one with some very influential Australian politicians, including Alfred Deakin in the late 19th century, who are involved in that. And again, there's problems with the Theosophical Society's understanding of India too, but it's a more sympathetic understanding than had hitherto existed in Australia. We also start to see there's an Australian communist by the name of Jack Ryan who visits India in the late 1920s, and he's also a journalist who writes extensively about the India that he sees, which is in flagrant contradiction to this Indian empire with tigers and elephants and maharajas and extraordinary wealth that has been the mainstay of a lot of Australian travel writing, and but also that sort of connects up with some of the writings of Kipling, which again heavily inform Australian ideas of India in the early 20th century. So what we start to see are these journalists who also use photography in their writing that start to interrupt this idea of a progressive India that is becoming westernized, and which demonstrates the extent of poverty, of working conditions, and of an interpretation that actually links these conditions to the fact of British imperialism itself as well. Now, there's a number of journalists. Jack Ryan's not the only one. Burchett's another one who is in India in the interwar period, and he comes back and writes extensively about Nehru and his observations of the Indian National Congress. And he self-publishes and writes to newspapers and starts to, again, interrupt some of these more imperial ideas about India in the 1920s and 1930s. And I do think that starts to make a shift by the 1940s.
Right. And with this, with the shift in the 1940s, it seems strange in the book you tell the story of R.G. Casey, who becomes the governor of Bangalore. And if there's a country that's on the verge of independence, moving toward that, and there's a shift of some degree in Australia, seems striking that an Australian would be put in charge of part of India.
So he was governor of Bengal for actually only 2 years, but the governor, I mean, Bengal as a province was one of British India's most critical provinces for a number of reasons. It was actually the first capital of India, Calcutta. It's moved to Delhi in 1911, but a lot of the infrastructure of the grand old capital of Calcutta is still in place. And this is where Casey goes to live. He's appointed for a number of reasons. I think Casey is actually a really interesting figure. He's a conservative. He is very anti-Cold War, but I think he understands and has a much better appreciation of India than anyone else in Australia, certainly, in the 1940s. And he's appointed to India on the back of his experience in a long international career working in London, in Washington, and subsequently in the Middle East, where he was in charge of supply during the Second World War. And he's appointed to Bengal, which is actually in the grip of a famine, a horrendous famine. And in fact, the role he's given is actually a poison chalice in many ways. It was very difficult to do a good job of administering Bengal in 1944. The famine had officially been declared in 1943, and even when it was officially declared, that was way too late. Food had been scarce in Bengal from early 1940. Prices had rocketed. And Bengal was a critical province for a number of reasons, not least because it was on the war front after the entry of the Japanese and the occupation of Burma, but because it was the home to a major industrial city, Calcutta, where Casey is, of course, based. And so strategically, from a war effort point of view, it was also critical for the British. Now, the problem is, of course, that the British fail to see it also as the home of a large population who gradually starts to die as food scarcity becomes a problem. And a lot of the food scarcity is actually created by British policy. Again, there's an enormous debate now in Britain about Churchill's role in this. Churchill and the War Cabinet in London, which are dictating policies but also refusing to change policies when they are pointed out to be killing large numbers of Bengalis. Policies which deny people of food, which requisition grain, implement a scorched earth policy, for example, so that the Japanese can't access food grains. But, of course, that also means that Bengalis can't access food grains as well. There's a reclamation of boats in the area, and, you know, the Bengali diet is heavily reliant then on rice and fish, and if you don't have boats, then you can't fish. And, again, these were all security policies made to secure Bengal from invasion, which end up creating mass death and suffering for Bengalis. And the rural areas are hit particularly hard. Large numbers of Bengalis come into Calcutta where they, you know, very slowly die on the streets of Calcutta. And meanwhile, there are, you know, people who work in essential industries are able to get access to rations. So we have people dying amid other people living reasonably comfortably. And when people try to help those who are dying, they simply die faster because once the body is beyond a certain point, it needs to be very slowly resuscitated with a medically supervised diet. And so, you know, middle-class Bengalis who felt sorry for people in advanced stages of starvation would give them food and it would just kill them even quicker because their bodies could no longer handle it. They needed to be medically rehabilitated. And that was a level of support that was not provided in nearly enough numbers.
Yeah, it
was a terrible time to be a governor of Bengal. It was a terrible time to be a Bengali, more importantly, I think.
Yes.
And Casey's given a role that is extremely difficult to actually perform well in. He doesn't perform perfectly, but he is deeply troubled, and I think it really shakes his idea of British imperialism after this.
Yes, and there's a cartoon you have from Norman Lindsay in the book with Casey arriving or moving through Bengal, and there's a salute, a military salute, and the caption is, "Are they firing at me or for me?" Which I thought was
So again, there was an enormous outcry at Casey's appointment. So in the course of the 20th century, one of the demands of Indian nationalists is that, well, if Indians can't go and live and work in Australia, then it stands to reason that Australians can't come and live and work in India. And in theory, that position was accepted as being reasonable, but it was never really legislated. Eventually, there is legislation in the 1940s which prevents men from the dominions working in India, but it's really only held for South Africa, where the discrimination is at its worst. In the case of Casey, he is appointed by the king, and that's actually not subject to Indian legislatures that are, you know, there are Indian Indians in legislatures by the 1940s in India, but they don't necessarily have a lot of autonomy, and they certainly are unable to overrule an appointment at this level. And so they all protest. There's a lot of protest at Casey's arrival, but it's just politely ignored. But it's something that Casey has to deal with throughout his tenure. He does actually win sections of the press over, especially in Calcutta, but the Delhi press in particular remains quite critical of Casey as being an Australian in a country where Indians, you know, still are not able to arrive in Australia, and yet an Australian is now taking part of the project of British imperialism in India. And that is seen as a problem.
Yes. Well, Carmel, we have to start wrapping up now, but I'd like to, if there's anything, are there any one final observation I would like, two observations I would like to make. One is the book has wonderful pictures in it. It's a very deep book, I found, very informative and a wonderful cover, beautifully designed book as well. So thank you for giving us this book. And the next thing is, I just have to say, we got through this interview without mentioning that sport that shares a name with an insect, which I think is probably a good thing. We can forget about that.
You must be talking about cricket.
Yes.
So my point in the book was actually to try to shift Australia-India bilateral relations, which has been ordered around what is often called three Cs: Commonwealth, curry, and cricket. And neither of these things, I think, are actually conducive to building good bilateral relations. Cricket is so competitive, and a lot of the time is actually conducted in again, very racial terms. And so I think it's something more to be perhaps less proud of. It's a competitive game, and we do have cricketers who have been really great in the Australia-India relations space. Brett Lee is perhaps the best example of this. He's done wonderful things, and I think has very good relationships with Indian players, but that can't be said of all Australian players. And so I would like it if we could actually find other ways of basing our international relations. And I think reminding Indians that we share a history in the British Commonwealth is also not particularly diplomatic, because our experiences as Australians and Indians' experiences were very, very different, and race was actually really central to the ways in which that experience played out. And so I think it's important for us to be mindful of those histories. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Karma, for that. And I should have said, Karma has attended this interview very early in the morning from the other side of the world in Germany. So thank you also for that and for your time today.
Thank you so much for your interest, Speed.
No, my pleasure. And that is the end of our interview with Karma. I would like to thank her, and this has been the New Books Network Australian and New Zealand Studies Channel. Thank you.